presenting on alcohol and drug abuse treatment for urban American Indians and Alaskan and Natives. So I feel like we've sort of been around the world here on this session.
Well, good morning. So we're going to continue the multicultural theme here, and I'll be talking about a project that's in much earlier stages than those that we've heard about earlier today. Basically, we're doing a longitudinal study following people, Native folks, who've entered into long-term residential substance abuse treatment in either Portland, Oregon or Seattle, Washington. I'll give you some of the baseline data on our participants and talk about the challenges of doing follow-up with this population. I was feeling a little better when I saw those Dallas follow-up data, and then I saw those Poland follow-up data, and now I feel terrible again. Anyway, no disclosures here. Here's our research team. We've got a multidisciplinary group here. I should say everybody on this slide is Native except me. And our principal investigator is Dr. Dale Walker, who was unable to be here today. Our organizations, Native American Rehab Association in Portland, Substance Abuse Treatment Agency, Seattle Indian Health Board also has a substance abuse treatment program, RMC Research, and the medical school in Portland. We're also supported by a National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. Very quick, well, we've got extra time this morning, so maybe I'll show you all my slides. I actually have some wonderful pictures from our powwow, but I couldn't get them to upload into the system, but they're on a CD here if you want to see great Native regalia. Anyway, so quick review on urban Native Americans, talk about substance abuse in the Native population, overview of the study and the baseline data, and then to get to the follow-up challenges. And by the way, I'm going to ask you to do a little work here as we get to the end of the discussion. And please give me some ideas on, and folks, you successful follower uppers here, give me some ideas on how to make contact with these individuals. So urban Natives, over the last few decades, American Indians and to some extent Alaskan Natives have moved off reservations and are now living in metropolitan areas. And you can see that there was a 10% change from 97 to 2002, and these numbers keep growing up. So these days, most Natives live in urban areas. There's certainly large numbers of American Indians still on the reservation, but most are in urban areas. Substance abuse problems, is well known that the Native population has very high prevalence of both abuse and dependence. I've just cited alcohol here, but it's also true for other substances. The literature review is going to be pretty quick here because there have been, I'll say, very little recent research on substance abuse treatment for urban Natives. That's actually saying none as far as we can find. So. There's also been very, very little research on substance abuse issues for Native women. And we're going to try to say a little bit on the female population also. Study objectives, we don't have to go through all this list. But suffice to say, it's long-term residential substance abuse treatment. We're interested in following folks up to 12 months after their entry into residential substance abuse treatment, and there are various other components to the project. Our two study sites in Portland and Seattle. So Native American Rehab Association got started as a substance abuse agency in 1970, has long-term residential program, also has outpatient treatment now, and about 20 years ago added primary health care to its programs. Many, many culturally specific services, sweat lodges, fire ceremony, drumming, flute, beadwork, and so forth. A strong focus on women and children, children of clients, special programs for child development and family strengthening. Seattle Indian Health Board got started in 1970 as a primary health care provider organization, added substance abuse treatment in 73, long-term residential and outpatient. Again, several culturally specific services, and special programs financed by the state of Washington, and also, interestingly enough, has a primary care medical residency program. So what we've got going on in the study, advertisement, recruitment, informed consent, baseline, collateral interview, extremely challenging finding collaterals for these folks, and then follow-up. Also interviewed all the staff qualitatively, staff surveys, reviewing records, looking at state administrative data in Oregon and Washington State. Here are the participants, self-defined natives, adults, spent at least one night in the residential substance abuse treatment program. We asked people if where they're going to live when they left substance abuse treatment, and we've tried to recruit people who said they were going to stay within 100 miles of either Portland and Seattle. I think that's one of our challenges, to say the least, and these were all volunteers. So several measures here, global assessment of individual need. I imagine you're mostly familiar with that, a gigantic interview. We typically can get that done in about 8 hours spread over the first few days of the residential treatment program. The adult biographical questionnaire is an interview focused on the native population. It contains many scales addressing issues of acculturation and identity, actually kind of analogous to the Korean instrument that we heard about earlier this morning, and then some other standardized data collection instruments. Okay. We tried to recruit about 200 folks. At this point, we're at about 70%. We're kind of coming to the end of recruitment here. Some demographics. From my point of view, these are all very young people, but they're mostly in the 30s and 40s. Background here. Very few born on a reservation. I mean, again, it's not a surprise, but if we'd done this study 30 years ago, the vast majority would have been born on a reservation. So these days, mostly folks are from urban or suburban areas. The vast majority, enrolled in one of the 562 federally recognized tribes. In our study, we've got at least 69 tribes represented, and this slide shows you the geographic dispersity here. I mean, not surprisingly, many from the Northwest, but in fact, large numbers of our participants are from all over the country. I think we've actually got tribal representation from throughout the United States. And as you see, in fact, the majority of the participants are from tribes located outside Oregon or Washington. Some more background, education, fairly low levels here. Many did not finish high school. Many did not marry. Many folks living alone. Unemployment, huge problem in this population. Homelessness, another gigantic challenge for these individuals. Overwhelming criminal justice system involvement. Many were in so-called controlled environments, kind of a polite term saying they were in jail before the intake into the residential treatment program. Many with mental health treatment, and quite a few with physical health problems. In terms of substance use, again, the vast majority started substance use before age 15. Overwhelming majority prior substance abuse treatment, daily use for most. And some, for whatever reason, were able to say at least that they didn't have any substance abuse problems in the month prior to entering residential treatment. In terms of what the popular drugs are, alcohol only for the men. Most of the male participants said alcohol was their, and of course tobacco, but alcohol was their only problem drug. For the women, they were much more Catholic, shall we say, or much more expansive in their choice of substances. Amphetamine, which really means methamphetamine, a large problem, especially for the women. And again, secondary substances, again, for the women, meth is a big issue here. So here's our challenge. So baseline is when they enter substance abuse treatment, try to motivate folks to stay about 90 days, more or less, in substance abuse treatment. There's substantial dropout, as you can imagine. So 3 months, these numbers are getting a little old now. We're doing a bit better, but nothing like Poland. So here we are, as we're coming to the end of the presentations here, certainly appreciate advice, comments. Just to give you a little bit of background here, when we started, we tried to collect collateral information for the participants, and that proved extremely difficult. Folks would tell us, yeah, I've got family, but I don't want anybody to contact them. And the few people who said they did have some family or friends, when we would call a collateral, yeah, I don't want to talk about them anymore. So we're having substantial opportunities for improvement here in our follow-up methodology. So homelessness, movement out of study area, another problem. We just don't have the resources to go out of state or actually even that far in state to follow people. Unfortunately, it's not infrequent that when we do find somebody for follow-up, they're intoxicated and may not really be able to provide much in the way of reliable information. So particularly focusing on Native women, and I think this is by far the largest study of Native women in substance abuse treatment I've ever heard of. Big issues for the Native women: unemployment, homelessness, methamphetamine, and then many research challenges here. So thank you.
Thank you, Benson. Well, we have time, a lot of time, for questions. Mike.
I have a question for you, and, well, actually a comment, and that is to suggest that the alcohol attribution finding in your results might not be as counterintuitive as you think, because if a person attributes the accident to alcohol, then he or she, you know, may be thinking of what they, you know, could do and might be more of a teachable moment. But if they don't make that connection, then it is the brief intervention that suggests that connection. And so it is reasonable to assume that those who receive the intervention would be more likely to attribute than the other way around.
So that's a good point. I'll put that in my paper. Thank you. I'm writing it right now. yes. Christine.
I had a question. First speaker?
Yeah.
I first had a simple question, then a more complex one. The first one is I wanted to know who actually provided the intervention. After Sherbert Falls, she had nurses provided it, so I wanted to know who provided it. And the other piece was it sounded like about 46% of the participants qualified for an alcohol use disorder, whereas the rest were going to be risky drinkers. And did you consider splitting those two groups to see if there was, because we know that brief intervention with those with alcohol use disorders in past studies haven't proved to be effective, and perhaps it would be nice to see the difference between, you know, large numbers between those mm-hmm. that were risky drinkers versus those that met the criteria for an alcohol use disorder.
Do you want to come up speaking?
Sure.
So to answer your first question, my understanding is they had health educators. They weren't nurses that were administering either the standard of care or the brief motivational interview. With regards to your second question, I wish I could answer it. I'm going to have to defer you to Craig Fields and Dr. Caetano to address that question, because I honestly don't know, since I wasn't involved with it. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I wish I could. You're right, absolutely. It would be very interesting. Yeah, I will.
Rachel.
Yes. I was interested in your study in terms of the number of people seeking treatment who had prior treatment. It was so low, and those in the follow-up, it was still very low. Was that due to a lack of treatment facilities, or is it cultural? And also, how might that have impacted your intervention in terms of
right.
people treatment?
Well, yeah, a couple things. One is that treatment was theoretically equally accessible to everyone. It turned out, in doing the training, that, and we didn't realize this till we got on site, that there was some sort of stigma involved in approaching subjects regarding treatment, unless they approached you regarding treatment. The nurses that actually did the intervention, I couldn't get into all the details, and there were a lot of sort of things that we wished hadn't been going on. One was that the nurses that did the intervention, they were actually on duty in the emergency department at the time. Now, the good part is that they, it's something that you might be able to implement easier because you aren't bringing in special study staff. Of course, the downside is that there may have been something going on that, you know, they didn't have a proper amount of time to devote to the intervention or whatever. But we did find from them when we were doing the training that they didn't feel real comfortable about just right off the bat suggesting that a person go for treatment. And so we don't really know how many even, everyone theoretically was given a referral list, but we don't know how much that particular aspect was pursued, especially with those who were dependent. Now, certainly when we did our little cluster chart, we got we sort of eliminated those that probably were quite dependent, but nevertheless, I'm sure we still had a number that were. I would just like to throw out one thing about these great follow-up rates in Poland, because it wasn't really me personally. Poland's a great place to do a study, as probably as a number of other countries, because they haven't been overstudied. And also, people don't move around in those kinds of more rural areas, especially in some of the Central European countries. So it's easier to find them. We also did a pilot study before we did the main study, and with the pilot study, we didn't actually do the brief intervention, but we identified people in the emergency room, and we assessed them, and we followed them later in 3 months and reassessed them just to see that we could do that and what the follow-up rates were in our sort of pilot study. And we found that we did not want to get cell phones from patients. We wanted to get as many hard lines as we could. And so we learned a lot from just doing the little pilot study as to what seemed to be obstacles in successful follow-up. Plus, we had a really committed staff who would go out and if they couldn't, the follow-up was by telephone, but they would actually go out and find the patients. And it was dual because it was sort of a circumscribed geographic area. So, you know, it just, there were circumstances that really made the follow-up very successful. Rob?
Yeah, hi. One of the things in a lot of these studies, they didn't really differentiate on age. And one of the things I'm doing is looking at college students, right? And there's massively different sensitive populations when you're looking at kind of dyed-in-the-wool alkies versus new heavy drinkers or problem drinkers. I wonder to what extent those kinds of things can be included or teased out, so to speak. I don't know the population of Poland might have a very different sensibility about it because they might be drinking earlier than college anyways, or I don't even know, but I'm not sure even in your population. I have a strong feeling that those kinds of populations are very different. The younger college age types of problem drinking versus the older dyed-in-the-wool types.
I think that's a very good point. In the study that I did, we did control for gender and age and analysis of covariance in looking at the effectiveness of brief intervention, but we didn't do separate analysis by age group. And I don't know.
Yeah, the graphs that were presented were adjusted for age and gender and injury severity and a number of other factors, but there wasn't a lot of comment about age in the paper that I've seen on the same study.
Yes.
I have a question for the gentleman. The ABC, the ABQ, the adult biographical questionnaire, I just wondered if you could speak a little bit more about that and if that is like accessible, is that a public document that I can look at? I'm just curious.
Do you want to come up?
Yeah,
with
okay. Yeah, use a microphone here. Although I'm happy to yell at people if you prefer. Anyway, adult biographical questionnaire. So the question pertained to this instrument, which is focused on American Indians and Alaska Natives. It was written by one of the co-investigators, Dr. Silkwalker. By the way, I've got some handouts up here if you're interested. If you'd like to send me an email, I'll forward it on to Dr. Silkwalker, and she can get you a copy. I don't want to say it's exactly in the public domain right at the moment because she'll beat me up when I get back to Portland. But it addresses several issues unique to the native population, in particular the blood, Indian blood quantum, which is Congress in its wisdom has decreed that part of the mechanisms for administering treaties and various other relationships between the federal government and tribal governments revolves around how much of your blood is said to be Indian. And so that's a complicated calculation, and it's based on responses to many items about your family history in the questionnaire. The instrument also includes several standardized scales, particularly by folks in Colorado named Auding and Beauvais, which kind of address this issue of acculturation. And do you identify yourself mostly as Indian or mostly as mainstream or somewhere in between? And there are also measures of activities that you might do regarding your native heritage, like how much time do you actually spend on the reservation and what ceremonies do you participate in, so forth. It's a fairly lengthy document. Typically takes roughly 2 hours for the interview. I mean, in theory, the participants can read it themselves and answer the questions. In practice, we read it to them. But at least in this population, we start with this biographical questionnaire, and the participants really kind of get involved with it because it gets right down to the native heritage, and that's a topic of considerable interest. So if you want to just send me an email, I'll pass along your interest. Thank you. So the suggestion was sort of internet follow-up procedures, Facebook, and yeah, that's an excellent idea. And certainly a fair number of native folk do have internet access. Many of the tribes nowadays have their own websites, their own webmasters and web shamans and so forth. So yeah, that's certainly the wave of the future here, and I think we may very well be looking at that with these participants.
I have also, I've worked with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the grants, mm-hmm. And I have a contact for the National Temple of Pequot Tribal Nation.
Excellent. Thank you. Let's swap.
And we've been invited to speak with the Tribal Health Affairs on alcohol and drug abuse.
Great. All right.
She coordinates the six New England tribes.
Oh, excellent.
So
very good.
I'm sure she'd be more than receptive to doing any research.
All right.
Extremely wealthy nation.
Yeah, there you go. All right, great. Let me go. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Gambling issues, too, then. New
England. Yeah.
No. They're actually, one is a tribal nation, the other one is a business. They're separate entities. Very, very separate entities.
Thank you for that information. Other questions? I think the time factor. I think that the emergency department is a difficult place really to do anything except emergency treatment for why the patient is there. And I know in primary care frequently it's usually by appointment. It's a bit more organized and probably easier to carve out a small piece of time for a brief intervention. I would think the time factor and then the personnel actually doing the brief intervention, and whether it's someone that sort of is already integrated into the staff, someone that is hired specially to do this. Rob.
I wanted to comment on that too. Yeah. That's really, really important because staff times, they do not like, although they'll give lip service to wanting to do this, unless you have infrastructure that is involving staff that isn't necessarily dealing with the emergent care problem at that point, things sort of don't happen. Yeah. So you've got to have some infrastructure. Or bringing in social workers, maybe might need some. It's changing slowly, right? I mean, becoming the expert stuff's becoming more and more valuable. And they're even trying to bill for it. But unless that really starts to happen, you're just not going to get a lot of actual involvement on the ground.
And I absolutely agree. And I just made that comment because in my clinic, we were fortunate enough to have significant buy-in with our provider. And so I was hired on as a health educator, and a small component of my duties is to take care of this program. We call it WICL, Wisconsin Initiative to Promote Healthy Lifestyles. And the goal, as my clinic sees it, is alcohol screening and drug screening becomes part of your normal health care. Everybody needs to get screened, and then you can reach more people if that needs to happen.
This is mandatory now in level one trauma centers in the U.S. to provide screening some kind of identification and treatment or referral. And I know the Bernsteins have used a model of health promotion advocates, and they've been sort of culturally and ethnically matched to whatever the emergency department clientele is. And I think they've had a great deal of success with their model. Yes. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you all for coming.
I moved out of community 50 years ago, and I think I've used but there's an internet on my back.
Part of the asteroid, and they didn't show a lot of. I was at the council meeting. This is really good stuff.
Yeah, that's great. I'm interested. And you mentioned some of the people who are
out of but I can think about it. Think it's important. And I would really.
There's sort of being in the
And also,
oh, yeah.